I got the rasp out of my vast box, held the tongue in one hand, and worked the rough surface along the teeth, checking occasionally with my fingers till the points had been sufficiently reduced. "Well, that's about right," I said after a few minutes. "I don't want to make them too smooth, or she won't be able to grind her food." John grunted. "Good enough. Now have a look at t'other. There's something far wrong with him." I had a feel at the gelding's teeth. "Just the same as the mare. Soon put him right, too." But pushing at the rasp, I had an uncomfortable feeling that something was not quite right. The thing wouldn't go fully to the back of the mouth. Something was stopping it. I stopped rasping and explored again, reaching with my fingers as far as I could. And I came upon something very strange, something which shouldn't have been there at all. It was like a great chunk of bone projecting down from the roof of the mouth. It was time I had a proper look. I took out my pocket torch and shone it over the back of the tongue. It was easy to see the trouble now. The last upper molar was overlapping the lower one, resulting in a gross overgrowth of the posterior border. The result was a saber-like barb about 3 inches long, stabbing down into the tender tissue of the gum. That would have to come off, right now. My jauntiness vanished and I suppressed a shudder. It meant using the horrible shears, those great long-handled things with the screw operated by a crossbar. They gave me the willies, because I am one of those people who can't bear to watch anybody blowing up a balloon, and this was the same sort of thing, only worse. You fastened the sharp blades of the shears onto the tooth and began to turn the bar slowly, slowly. Soon the tooth began to groan and creak under the tremendous leverage, and you knew that at any second it would break off, and that when it did, it was like somebody letting off a rifle in your ear. That was when all hell usually broke loose, but mercifully this was a quiet old horse, and I wouldn't expect him to start dancing around on his hind legs. There was no pain for the horse because the overgrown part had no nerve supply. It was the noise that caused the trouble. Returning to my crate, I produced this dreadful instrument, and with it a houseman's gag which I inserted onto the incisors and opened on its ratchet till the mouth gaped wide. Everything was easy to see then, and of course, there it was. A great prong on the other side of the mouth, exactly like the first. Great. Great. Now I had two to chop off. The old horse stood patiently, eyes almost closed, as though he had seen it all, and nothing in the world was going to bother him. I went through the motions with my toes curling, and when the sharp crack came, the white-bordered eyes opened wide, but only in mild surprise. He never even moved. When I did the other side, he paid no attention at all. In fact, with the gag prizing his jaws apart, he looked exactly as though he was yawning with boredom. As I bundled the tools away, John picked up the bony spicules from the grass and studied them with interest.
"Well, poor old beggar. Good job I got you along, young man. Reckon he'll feel a lot better now."
On the way back, old John, relieved of his bale, was able to go twice as fast, and he stumped his way up the hill at a furious pace, using the fork as a staff. I panted along in the rear, changing the box from hand to hand every few minutes. About halfway up, the thing slipped out of my grasp, and it gave me a chance to stop for a breather. As the old man muttered impatiently, I looked back, and could just see the two horses. They had returned to the shallows and were playing together, chasing each other jerkily, their feet splashing in the water. The cliff made a dark backcloth to the picture, the shining river, the trees glowing bronze and gold, and the sweet green of the grass. Back in the farmyard, John paused awkwardly. He nodded once or twice, said, "Thank you, young man," then turned abruptly and walked away. I was dumping the box, thankfully, into the boot when I saw the man who had spoken to us on the way down. He was sitting cheerful as ever in a sunny corner, back against a pile of sacks, pulling his dinner packet from an old army satchel.
"You've been down to see pensioners, then? By gore, our John should know the way."
"Regular visitor, is he?"
"Regular? Every day God sends you'll see town fella plodding down there. Rain, snow or blow, never misses, and always has somewhat with him. Bag of corn, straw for their bedding."
"And he's done that for 12 years. The man unscrewed his thermos flask and poured himself a cup of black tea.
"Aye. Them horses haven't done a stroke of work all that time, and you could have got good money for them from the horse flesh merchants. Rum run, isn't it?
Yeah, you're right, I said. It is a rum run. Just how rum it was occupied my thoughts on the way back to the surgery. I went back to my conversation with Siegfried that morning. We had just about decided that the man with a lot of animals couldn't be expected to feel affection for individuals among them. But those buildings back there were full of John Skipton's animals. He must have hundreds. Yet what made him trail down that hillside every day in all weathers? Why had he filled the last years of those two old horses with peace and beauty? Why had he given them a final ease and comfort which he had withheld from himself? It could only be love.